As we mentioned during the last committee session, all of these two are attempted to the invention of the device, but in fact, the device is only the beginning of the process.
Well, that's true too. It then had to be developed and used with the materials that we're talking about, and the polymer moving screws play a great part in integrated circuitry. As a matter of fact, it's sort of come to a circle there, Justin, that, as we said, have you ever walked down the hall, you're passing the film laboratories, one down there. There are a lot of exciting things we set up in the late 70s that are almost chemical syntheses of integrated circuits. They involve a series of chemical steps. You and Ralph said this very well. He's more than pointing out how you're just making chemically a set of devices which then function under the conditions we require now. Well, at this stage, when our devices were hopelessly crude, heavy, big, awkward, and all that, there was nevertheless the same requirement for chemical synthesis around them, you see, to make them function. So that's involved in the original formation of the device, as well as in the point you make about the application of it.
Yeah, it's important to have that sense of cooperation between different areas of the lab. When most of the history of solid state development that at Bell has focused on in fact, there was as much work and as much important work going on in the mechanical
world. Well, absolutely. And the people who made those, the fundamental contributors to the device of Battenbarty and Chaffee for the transistor, the laser, the pounds and tolerance, were the first to say this. Mm-hmm. They were the first to say that it was a particular enzyme with combined input from chemists and physicists. Engineers and others, that really made those.
Before we round off this discussion of the immediate post-war period and move on at least briefly to the beginning of your administrative career at the lab, how was the environment in the late 40s, early 50s, as far as collaboration and exchange of information, different from before the war, if it was different?
I think it was, Andy. Thanks very much. That's a humane treatment, but what you might have been trying to do is produce a gag.
It's a chemical, so it's too loud.
Good for you. I'll be hydrated. Interactions, I think, were much stronger than before the war, for the simple reason that we'd all worked together during the war by necessity. We had seen in the course of that working together that combined science and science combined with technology just went way beyond the compartmentation which was fashionable and expected before the war. Before the war, our business was dominated by very ingenious electrical engineers. The Davidson, Germers, Beckles, others who have done historic work in physics, highly respected around the world, were not taken very seriously by the bulk of our staff, or largely admirable people who didn't have very much to do with telephones. Whereas after the war, it was clear that if we're going to make microwaves work, if we're going to make new switching work, if we're going to make computers work, if we're going to make the whole realm of the signaling systems work, we would have to combine all these skills. So it was a change spirit. It didn't really reach. It's a thing that evolved very steadily over many decades, and probably didn't reach a strong peak until the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, it really became crucial there, but it's built up during all that period.
One thing that you mentioned was something that also struck me. You said that there was a feeling after the war that that science and technology together would accomplish more than if one maintained the artificial compartmentalization. So it did seem to me that that the work that you and your collaborators were involved in, while still maintaining an interest in basic polymer science, was much more practically oriented and had very important results. I'm thinking, for instance, of the work on the complex stressing of polyethylene that we talked about. That was something that, again, used the same strategy of understanding the molecular structure and then to link that understanding to physical properties, and then had very real and immediate practical benefits.
Right.
And this seems to also characterize the work that you did with Winslow it led to work in composites, but it was on the carbon of different kinds of polymers. Does that seem like a reasonable characterization that was?
Yes, it's very accurate. The major reason that the chemical laboratory in the Bell Laboratory was always a hybrid. Unlike mathematics and physics and some other communications fields, it had one foot or one hand or hopefully one frontal lobe in engineering. The engineers whom I spoke about a while ago, who were elegant, inventive people, looked at materials as something that was bound to cause trouble, and that chemists were the only people that might be able to relieve a little of that. You see, and that was their rights, you know. I mean, for the first 30 years of telephony, the materials were a limiting factor. You made the metal blocks work, or you made the natural rubber work, or something. So the chemical laboratories were pretty close to engineering and application over all that period. And that tradition did persist. It persisted strongly. For example, on the polyethylene, the engineers, and they've written this up very well, and much more aggressive about it, took the steps to design the sheets, which I believe are revolutionary in the whole world of electrical and electronic distribution. They found some of the troubles, all right, they expected they would be, and then, you see, chemistry had to get very deeply involved. We had suggested the use of the material in the first place, but these engineers went ahead with their designs, they were development people, and the very complex processing that had to be done, and then the stress behavior became absolutely essential for controlling their product. Somebody has probably told you, I think you probably have seen much of the record they made, the outside plant people, about 4 or 5 years ago. Gillette put all this together, and it turned out that this feeding program alone saved in cost, generated in extra earnings, the cost of the whole research in the laboratory for about 10 years. That's that one item, you see. So there's a big leverage here. That's another reason that practice and theory and basic science and application get fairly intimately connected. And we could do it because we were an integrated company. Now, a lot of chemical companies have trouble on that. They might make some very good material, but never find out whether they processed this way, or whether they needed other physical understanding, or whether they needed chemical modification because they'd sell it to somebody who would try to make the product and then would sell the pieces.
Yeah. That's in your clipping that I was just, you talked about the work of Winslow leading to
the primary carbon
in heat fields. I wonder if you'd say something else about that.
We got very interested in the semiconductor properties that we had worked on, that I had worked on with Becker. And on the one hand, we saw that carbon in the microphones was a semiconductor and hard to control. We had this work of Lowry years ago. One of the reasons we got interested in coal is because there were only certain batches of anthracite that would work We've guarded them more jealously than gold, little black gold idea was really embodied in that stuff. It was under complete guard and preservation. All the microphones of the barrel system were made out of it, and if you didn't have those, you didn't have a telephone. We thought this was a sort of a sad situation, and so we said, well, on the one hand, there are kind of deeper implications of these films, semiconductor organic films. On the other hand, carbon in the microphone is behaving that way. It's doing that. It's doing the way Edison found out. It's forming a contact surface. It's got a junction-like property there. And so we said synthesis should be able to deal with it. On the one hand, synthesis in terms of mechanical shape, because the microphones are much influenced also by the granularity of that carbon. And we said, well, we can make some completely spherical carbon. At least we'll know mechanically how it behaves. It won't pack in the microphone in a strange way, and it will have some fluid properties that we'll understand by models, or if any good or not, we'll know. On the other hand, we will know what composition is, and we'll be able to vary that and see if we can optimize it. So that's what set us off on this, and Winslow had been interested in properties of materials, organic structures during the war, so we set off to synthesize things which could be converted into semiconducting forms. We knew one way to do that would be to dehydrogenate if we didn't just depolymerize. The way you dehydrogenate without depolymerizing would be to cross-link, as we did with microgel, very intensely, and perhaps cause some other chemical modifications, which we did mostly by oxidizing, but in some cases we didn't even oxidize. And these things were formed, dehydrogenated forms of very wide range of properties. There was a meeting that down at first place 2 weeks ago, I guess, on the natural science group, but they were describing not only the adduct and baked polymers that Cooper and other folks are pursuing, but also polyacetylenes, which were chemically almost identical to the films that we made by dehydrogenation, and they have almost the same properties. That was how we got along that side of it. But then we continued to dehydrogenation in this geometric form of very fine spheres. So you've probably seen some of these. If not, I'll show you some. They're really quite interesting, very metallic looking things. To see how an idealized particle microphone should behave. And the physicists and telephone engineers did that. We worked with them for a few years, and Manny Gisdell, who was originally one of the chemists in this, went over to head the telephone instrument part of it, and we worked very closely with him. We then got to the composite and the, well, first the modulus by finding out that the polymers we were dehydrogenating, as we converted to almost pure carbon form, were harder, more rigid than any form we had seen in a carbon before. And you see, that was partly embodied in these geometric forms, which were, we know, fibers as well as spheres, and films as well as fibers. And then that showed up as very high modulus material. We studied tape and I, so we were the tape. The structures tape, this was something in between which people in England and other places had recognized you could get by pyrolytic carbon. They did it by pyrolysis from the vapor. And we thus identified in a very strong Tom Parvis, I was interested in that because I'd been serving by that time with some of the Air Force laboratories which were trying to make rocket cones and rocket cases and using boron fibers, which were very good, except they were almost impossible to get, and this carbon was much, much easier to get. Now, around about that time, we started some of that work at the International Congress of Pure and Applied Chemistry in New York, I guess it was 53, 54. There began to be a little stirring about rocketry, and when Sputnik went off, of course, there was this mobilization, which was fairly familiar to us because of the wartime experience, and there was a rocket and jet group formed in the Pentagon, so-called VAR, Rocketry Propulsion Chrysler Corporation, and they set out to find out how to make the ICBMs and most particularly the nose cones that were required for the containment of nuclear weapons, since the Soviets had threatened to do that step in their rocketry, and we had found out even before Sputnik that they were quite far along in pursuing that. Well, there was a group, there were several groups then organized in the National Academy of Sciences, which Jewett, I guess, had relinquished his presidency then, but he had stimulated them to do this, to try and find out what the latest science could be for making ICBMs and for generally enabling us to enter the missile and rocket space age. And it was found that these nose cones were very demanding. They were thought they could make them of copper beryllium alloy, and we supposed that that would be adequate. They have tremendous heat, as you know, when they re-enter. But this alloy was fairly refractive, hard to make, but Lockheed was working on it. But they also asked a group in the Academy of Sciences to see what alternatives might be, and we were assigned, we being Hans Fernauer, who was a ceramics leader, James Slater, who was the inventor of fiberglass, and myself, to see whether we could do anything outside of metallic range. You see, that was a logical idea, because you had somebody who knew about silicates and somebody later and fibers, and somebody who knew about ceramics, which might be alumina or something, which was Fernauer, and then somebody who was fanatic about polymers, which was I, and it didn't take us long, although we did all sorts of other things. I think you have a copy, perhaps, of this report, but if not, it can be produced. There are copies of it, and a copy to the Secretary, which said, well, we've looked at, we've analyzed the requirements for re-entry and for rocket propulsion. You folks can have this too, if you want. It's a rather interesting little accent on 20th century science. But we believe that the way to make rockets, but particularly to make their nose cones so that they will not disintegrate on re-entry, is has chemical base. Namely, we find that the ablation, which we use to make these polymer carbon particles, these spheres and the like, has very high energy absorption. On the other hand, you maintain the shape. You change the structure, but you maintain the shape. And we think this will work. It looks like something is burning up, but we think it will come out as a very refractory, very enduring substance. Well, they accepted that and assigned Drew at Valley Forge, particularly, to task of engineering, which they did extremely well. We have slides which I used to show. Fred Meisenhower, and he was offered. He insisted that those first two notes terms that were used with were tested out over the South Atlantic, and we went over to that island. But somewhere, it was an island that southwest of the Azores. You folks probably have been there, but anyway, it was a place that we also had done rocket tests in later years, but this was the first. And went down there so they could recover the nose cones, you see, because they wanted to find out what was going on. And sure enough, they had survived, and they didn't, obviously didn't have a nuclear warhead inside, but they had all instruments which would have described what the warhead would have been doing. And with all of that together, President Eisenhower insisted they bring them into his office and take a picture of it. So these nose cones are totally different, but they did. We got a picture of it in the Oval Office, and President Eisenhower beaming there, because it did put us finally on the track counterforce to the Russian ICBM threat. And when Beta got the Bush Award a couple of weeks ago down in Washington, I had fun with him for banquet disposal, reminding him how he and I went out. We were sent at that time, which was 1957, I guess, to the Lockheed plant in Sunnyvale to see how they were doing on the first Polaris missiles. Which had to have the same property, you see, but they had gone a long distance down the road by then with the old copper billion nose cone. Never tried it out, but it was really a very serious restraint on the Polaris missiles, which were much smaller than the first ones we were using. And Beta and I, and for those members of PSAC, we've been taken into the White House Science Committee by then. Went in there and shuddered at what we saw being constructed all over that huge Lockheed plant, because we didn't think they would last and they would work in the Polaris system, and we managed to convince them to switch that to ablating nose cones. Well, Beta remembered that with some interest. But that is how this ablating structure got introduced, and this is long answer to how Winslow and I got started in that particular field.
Fascinating. Was the report that you mentioned in 57 also, or was it?
I think it was either 56, 57. I really should, if you don't have it, I'll look it up and get one. There are not many copies, but there are some.
Well, that jumps us ahead to some of your science advisory work for the government, which I doubt we'll be able to cover today. That's a story in itself, I'm sure, if you think.
Yeah, that's another era which has to do with the system and the ABD's feeling of national mission and responsibility. A certain amount of that did come out of the war experience, however, but a fair amount of it came out of the civilian side as well. And that has had ramifications which I think probably would be better treated on another occasion, such as the formation of the National Materials Program, which, as you know, that is still very much in its vigor. Penn was one of the three first selected sites, and chemistry is playing an expanding role, but it's taken a long time to really get to. And I think I said before, there'll be a major survey of this this fall in the National Academy on 28th or 29th October. It's I think good chemical archivists and historians will want to keep an eye on that, because chemistry has been the absolutely central factor, but it has influenced many, many other fields so strongly that it'll be interesting to see how it comes out in October.
Let me just ask you two final questions about related to swimming. I asked you the last time we talked about this will be the second question. I asked you the last time we talked about how one got information about polymer research in the late 30s when germs are around. And we spoke a bit about following the journals and so on. And I'm interested to know how things have changed by the early 50s with the experience of the synthetic rubber project and other polymer related research in the world.
Well, it carried on very much along the lines that Larry correctly outlined for the transition between the war and the 50s, and 1950 or the early 50s. Namely, the rest of the 50s moved along that line. The chemistry work expanded a lot. It became very basic to the solid state era. It was exercised by the developers of the transistor, the diode, the whole digital circuitry era which was coming in then. See, about 7% of the total national investment in plant, total capital investment of the USA, was done by the Bell System in that period, 1960, each year 7%. About 1962 to 1 to about 1971. So huge investment in materials, because materials were intrinsic to all that plant that was built, a huge plant. Chemistry got deeper and deeper.
Well, that's the best context for understanding the role of chemistry in the Bell System in the 30s and 40s. How about within your group, just to ask a much more specific question, within the polymer research group at Bell Labs, did you now find you were following any journal polymer science, or was it still that one read Jack to find out what was going on?
We did both. No, we felt very strongly that the field was spending the same year right on, but we invested as heavily as we could in the national commitments and the international commitments. The journals, the whole bibliographic side became extremely important, and we participated in that, which was still represented on, I'm still a part of the Journal of Polymer Science section, but I think our people have other bibliographic investments too. And we felt that the world growth of that field was paralleling very much the expansion that we did. But as the people joined us, Fletcher came in about the 1950 period. He's now the head of the whole materials lab before he switched from the executive director. But he started out with the polymer work and expanded it. McCall followed him. He's now the chemical director. So it's been a very steady growth.
Were instrument mechanisms still important in the early 40s and early 50s? I think, for instance, again, from the case files in the late 30s and early 40s, the Gibson Island conference figures very prominently in that. I noticed that you went to a number of them, other people from Dell also went. They led to correspondence and interest from investors. They later became the Gordon conferences, as you well know. Were there any sorts of informal mechanisms for exchange information polymers still important?
They were very much, very important, very much esteemed. Some of the reasons are kind of interesting. We were one of the few industries that were not producing polymers in a significant way, but we were a tremendous user. We therefore had the confidence of many of the other industrial components, people who were producing them. And because they didn't think we would betray their secrets, which we didn't. They had any secrets. But as a byproduct of this, we encouraged interaction among them. We encouraged them not to be so nervous and fidgety that they were going to tell each other secrets all the time. It turned out not to be that way, which the publication really happens, and these things get known much faster than they thought they were getting known. Have to maintain secrecy for a while, of course, but it's not over the years that they do. And so we were modest factors in encouraging these informal meetings, and they were especially Egyptian island Gordon was, which we took a very strong part in. But they were the Saturday sessions with Brook and Parry and Rump sessions with the Mountain Society and Physical Society and so on. We gave the original papers by Sebastian and I at the inaugural session of the Mountain Physical Society Division of Polymer Physics, which up to that point was at Rochester. Mm-hmm. At that point, they decided that whatever polymers had, they didn't have any physics. We changed that a little bit. The buyer was pleased. This was about 950, I guess. And those kinds of interactions were much improved.
So that's important for us. And one of the agendas that Chuck has is to learn a little bit more about polymer science program. And yeah. So that seems important to know. I guess we ought to move on to your administrative career. You've been talking about work that was still going on in the early 50s when you had become assistant director of the chemical laboratories. And I wonder if you would reflect a little about how what you did on the job was changed, or must have changed, when you became assistant director.
Yes, well, I was in the laboratory, during most of that period. That is, started, I guess, 51, by 54,